Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Richard Sanderson. And Richard's about to introduce our guest, Mark Stevenson.
Hello. Mark Stevenson formerly worked as an expert in both prime number cryptography and computer-aided systems engineering. Today, he combines two other careers, one as a successful writer-comedian, writing for TV, radio and print, and another as a speaker and consultant on future narratives, institutional innovation, engineered serendipity, and I want to ask you about that, and learning. He is
a co-founder... You've read my website very well.
He is a co-founder and director of the cultural learning agency Flow Associates and the science communication agency Re-Agency. A new mobile project engendering conversations and stimulating learning and direct action with an audience of 30 million users. The age of smart is coming in mid 2011. I shouldn't have had that pint. Mark is a fellow of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. Mark is the author of the book we're going to be talking about today, An Optimist's Tour of the Future. Welcome to Little Atoms, Mark.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure, and I thank you for the pint as well we had in the bar before we got
wasn't
here.
Wasn't it enjoyable?
Yes.
So, an optimist. I was wondering whether, did you find, after all your travels and encountering all these scientists, did you find your optimism challenged, or did you find yourself becoming an optimist as you went through this? Because there aren't many optimists in the science world, are there?
Oh, well, I don't think that's true at all. I think to be a scientist is, by definition, to be an optimist. You're always looking for the new. But... to be honest, the book didn't start off with the word optimist in the title. Right. When it was originally pitched, it was simply a world tour of the future. I wanted to make sense of the scientific horizon for myself, really. You know, I couldn't find a place which was understandable yet scientifically accurate where I could find out answers to the big questions. You know, what is nanotech about? You know, what is biotech going to do for us? What's happening with the internet? Can Andrew Lloyd Webber be stopped? You know, these very important questions. But by the time I'd come back, I realised there were so many opportunities for a brighter future that I hadn't heard about. That actually my agent suggested putting the word optimist in the title. So I'm not an optimist by disposition, but I became convinced that we do have choices. So I'm not saying the future will be better, because it could be terrible. It could end up being like Kylie Minogue, you know, exciting but short. But it could end up, you know, being a renaissance, and that option is still very much on the table. And I wanted to make sure that more people knew about it, because the one thing I do know is if you can't imagine a better future, you certainly can't make it happen.
So how did you approach writing the book? I mean, it's in the form of a journey, I suppose, as you go and visit these scientists. Did you have a plan at the start, or did it sort of write itself almost?
I deliberately didn't set out with a plan. One of the things you find about a lot of popular science books is they are written from a perspective from the beginning. Somebody has a story to sell. They want to tell you about their particular area, or they you know, they want to give you a particular story. And I really wanted to throw myself in the deep end and be very much like, I guess, the average person, which is I don't know what's going on. I'm going to ask a bunch of questions. I'm going to see where that takes me. So absolutely, I didn't have an agenda other than what's next, you know, what's going to happen. And I started off deliberately throwing myself in the deep end. I want to see the transhumanists at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, and these are the people who believe we'll be able to transcend our biology by, you know, using technology or biotech and merge with our machines. And so that was a complete car crash, and then I started to unravel that, and from there I went off to see MIT to talk about robotics and artificial intelligence, and you know, all this happens in the context of the climate. So I just sort of followed my nose to try and find out, you know, answers to the questions as they occurred to me. And I think that's probably one of the good things about the book, in that as a reader you're probably reaching the same questions at the same time I am, and I'm not selling you anything. I'm going, I don't know either.
Well, one of the things I was delighted to read something about was nanotechnology, which is a phrase I've heard a lot about, and I knew it meant science, something to do with science and very, very small things.
Yeah.
The chapter about that in the book was fascinating. So, first of all, I mean, the first mind-blowing thing was when you started to talk about how small nanotechnology actually is. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, The thing about nanotechnology is I had the same thing, which is all I know about it really is it's just something really, really, really tiny, and then apparently magical things happen down there. And what I came to realise was that nanotechnology isn't really about scale, although the scale is important. There's a reason the Industrial Revolution wasn't called the yard-long technology revolution. It was about new ways of manufacture, and you saw lots of disciplines collide in the Industrial Revolution, new ways of designing things and new ways of making things. And what you're seeing now is that happening again, but on a different scale. But if you concentrate on the scale, you're missing the point. What it's about is manufacture, and doing things at that scale allows us to do interesting things, arranging atoms in atomically precise ways. And you know, we're used to seeing this in nature. If you arrange a bunch of atoms in one way, you'll get a diamond. If you arrange them in another way, you'll get some coal. But if you arrange them in another way, using nanotechnology, you'll get something like a carbon nanotube, which has 50 times the tensile strength of steel.
Indeed, you talk several times during the book about desktop factories, I think it is. Could you tell us what one of those would be? I mean, it sounds pretty fanciful at the moment.
Well, it is fanciful, and the jury is very much out on that. I went to see a man called Eric Drexler who is very much championing this idea of basically a matter printer, which will take in very simple chemical feedstock, so you know, carbon atoms or whatever, and you'll be able to print pretty much anything you like very, very cheaply by arranging them in an atomically precise manner. Now, the jury is very much out on whether he is right or wrong. And in fact, actually, there's a big schism in the nanotechnology field about this. And a lot of people say, a lot of chemists in particular say, you know, you can't arrange atoms that well down there because it's just too much like a mosh pit at a death metal gig to get an assembly line going. And he's saying, now I understand all that, but there's enough that we can get right, so we can create things, you know, with much more precision than we do at the moment, and that unleashes all sorts of superpowers for all sorts of elements.
Let's perhaps look at some of the ways in which nanotechnology is being used at the moment, because as you said, the idea of the nano factory is slightly fanciful, is a future idea. But there is stuff going on, and Stuart Brand, who was a previous guest on the show, has called nanotechnology revolutionary times revolutionary. So let's talk about perhaps what he means about that. What things are actually happening?
Well, nanotechnology is kind of at the stage, I would say, that the manufacture of microprocessors was in about 1970. Okay, so we're just getting to the idea that we can start to handle matter at these levels of granularity, and we've got a lot to learn. There is going to be a massive explosion, and you'll start to see matter being treated in some of the ways that the data is treated by microprocessors. We still don't know the limits of that, and that's what the debate is about. But for instance, one of the things I was very pleased to find out about is that by marshalling materials at this much finer level of granularity, we can create water filtering membranes that can desalinate things much more cheaply than we've been used to. And one of the big problems has been that we're worried about water wars because, you know, to desalinate stuff actually takes a huge amount of energy. Mm-hmm. But with these new nanomembranes and various techniques that are involved with nanotechnology, which we don't have time to go into here, actually that spectrum has pretty much been taken off the table. And it's not just me that's saying that. You know, the Toffler Institute have recently said the same thing. So I don't think we have to worry about water wars. And in fact, I was in a meeting yesterday talking about this particular nanomembrane that they think is going to revolutionise desalination.
But how far away is that?
Oh, well, it's happening now. I mean, there are people implementing that now. In fact, I was talking to some scientists yesterday who have licensed their nanomembrane technology to a large corporate because this corporate is going to make, they think, a fortune out of desalination technologies. So, you know, they're not going to worry too much about, you know, they're not going to drag their heels, is what I'm saying. They're going to get out there and do it. Because a lot of governments around the world, you know, especially in the hotter countries, are really worried about this. So, yeah, that stuff will be happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
Can you, as an optimist, very quickly demolish grey goo for me? Because that was always the big scare story about nanotechnology. And perhaps explain for those of us who are not quite sure what it is anyway, what grey goo was.
Well, first of all, as I say, I'm not an optimist by disposition. I'm not a wishful thinker. I have no time for that. Wishful thinking is a combination of denial and hope, which basically leads to apathy. I'm a convinced optimist. I think we can do things. Mm-hmm. But grey goo is this kind of myth, which Eric Drexler, I have to say, is slightly responsible for propagating, the idea that you'd be able to create this tiny nano machine that would replicate itself. And then there'd be two of them, and then it would replicate itself, and then there'd be four of them. And pretty soon, you know, once you've got an exponential growth like that, you know, basically it would eat the entire universe, you know, within a matter of hours. I mean, it's not quite that, but that's the... And Michael Crichton actually wrote a book based on this called Prey, which is based on this whole idea that, you know, these things would replicate and replicate and replicate, and before you know, we'd all be consumed in this thing called grey goo. The way you sort of demolish that argument is you have to look, well, is there anything in nature that does that? I mean, look at it, it's massively energy inefficient. There is no, not even a virus, that just keeps on, keeps on, keeps on replicating itself and destroying everything, because actually then it dies itself.
Yeah.
So there's a natural limit to that kind of stuff. So Grey Goo's only act of replication really is as an idea that's very fanciful and very attractive to science fiction writers. But it's almost unlikely to happen. You'd have to really, really work hard to try and create something that did that. And Eric Drexler said to me, you know, have you ever seen a car that gets pregnant and gives birth to another car? No, you haven't, because it's just a ridiculous way of trying to manufacture anything. And similarly, the whole premise on which Grey Goo is based is similarly ridiculous. Although he did say if somebody tried to create something like this, it would be dangerous. But eventually, of course, it would run out of fuel.
Yeah. But it would stay, you know, in the hands of the wrong people, it would be a horrible thing.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to give it to Andrew Lloyd Webber. Who knows what he might do with that? We'd have replicating Lemmys, you know, forever. Did he write
Lemmys?
He
didn't write that.
Oh, well, so there you go. Sorry about that, Andrew. I hate your other stuff, though.
Despite the nonsensicalness of the idea of grey goo, you do list numerous other doomsday scenarios that have been sort of attached to nanotechnology. So perhaps we should look at, you know, some of the other works.
There are numerous doomsday scenarios attached to every technology, and rightly so. Though, you know, we could absolutely wipe ourselves out with some of the technology we have now in biotech and nanotech and infotech as well. And what's interesting about nanotech, I think, is it radically changes potentially our relationship with scarcity, because if you can start to marshal atoms in with that level of precision, then there is the possibility on the table that a lot of the reasons for going to war or being aggressive sort of disappear, because we get an idea of locally manufactured abundance. I suppose the most credible nanotech apocalypse of the five I go into the book, I won't get into them all here, is the idea of ubiquitous surveillance, where you can have nanobots sort of looking at everything. And Eric Drexler said to me, the thing you should worry about is not terrorism, so people getting hold of nanoweapons, but the ability to suppress anything like terrorism. That's the scariest thing. On balance, I think that probably wouldn't happen. What you tend to find is as surveillance technologies increase, so do anti-surveillance technologies. So, for instance, right now, you can buy technologies that will tell you if there's a Wi-Fi signal anywhere near you that's broadcasting, and you can detect it. And there's technologies that find, you know, small camera lenses or whatever. So I'm pretty sure we'll also have a nanotech immune system. You know, people tend to concentrate on all the bad stuff and forget that the same technology can be used to mitigate that.
But the bad stuff is so exciting.
It is exciting, isn't it? That's why we all, you know, that's why James Cameron has a job.
You're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Richard Sanderson, and we're talking to Mark Stevenson about his book, An Optimist's Tour of the Future. So, as you just quite relevantly brought in James Cameron there, I want to move on to talk about robotics and where we are with AI at the moment. And I suppose what I'd really like to know is how close are the robots to sending somebody back from the future?
Well, it's not just you've got to invent time travel at that point as well, which is a separate and slightly more intractable problem. I think we're almost nowhere near the robots coming back from the future to destroy us.
So more seriously then, in the book you talk about the sort of quest to basically replicate human-like, human-ish emotions in robots. So let's talk a little bit about where we are with that.
Yeah, I went up to MIT to see a lady called Cynthia Brazil, who is trying to create what she calls searchable robots, robots that we engage with in a way that was recognisably human. They have human cues. And I met a robot out there called Leo and another one called Nexie, and they're robots that, you know, if they don't understand, they kind of, you know, shrug their shoulders, and if they're listening, they cock their head and all that kind of stuff. And that's quite good in a way, because it actually enables us to create interfaces with our machines that are much more fluid and understandable. So rather than you shouting at your computer going, why did you delete that when I meant to save it? It kind of knows you're getting annoyed. It goes, oh, hang on, is there something going on here I should know about? The idea of whether computers have emotions or can think to themselves is still very much a moot point. People have been talking a lot about Watson, the computer that has famously won Jeopardy. The thing there is, you know, Watson answers lots of questions, but can it ask one? And it can't. So what AI tends to do is do really good things in very constrained situations. So, you know, it's quite easy to get a computer to beat Gary Kasparov at chess, but that same computer can't, you know, make you a cup of tea or ask you out on a date. You know, it can't do anything that is multi-purpose and intelligent in the way that we think. And of course, our intelligence is based around the fact that we exist in multiple ways and bring them all together. So a lot of AI is very useful at doing what it does, but it's useful in the way that a hammer is very good at opening a packet of crisps. It will do it, but it's kind of overkill. And we're a long way off putting all those things together. Now, that's not to say there aren't some interesting advances, and perhaps the most important thing about the research into robotics and AI is that it helps us frame very big philosophical questions. You know, what is consciousness? What does it mean to think? What does it mean to have a belief? What is a lie? And if we can create machines that do that, or try to, then we're framing those questions about big philosophical things we've always struggled with slightly better. We might find out that what is consciousness is actually 8 separate smaller questions that the roboticists are trying to solve. And even if they don't solve them, they've helped us frame a question we've always struggled with better.
Do you think, has the image of robots and AI has been, like, you know, it's been a mainstay of sort of science fiction, and do you think that has coloured the way we look at it? And are the people that are researching AI at the moment, are they, you know, are they aware, are they working within those constraints that you talked about? Do people still have the idea that they could have a C-3PO type robot?
Well, Cynthia, who I went to see at MIT, who's the head of the personal robotics lab, she was absolutely inspired by C-3PO as a kid. She saw C-3PO in Star Wars when she was, you know, 6 years old or whatever, and went, I want to build one of those. Which is why she ended up at MIT. Mm. Most of us, we watch Star Wars and go, I want to be Han Solo or Princess Leia. She went, no, I want to build C-3PO. Which is, you know. So, you know, they are definitely driven by that. And they're driven by good reasons. They want our machines to be more collegiate with us. But she definitely believed that the word robot really didn't express what she was doing. She's trying to create a separate personality. She believes we're a long, long way off it.
You do bring up the sort of mind-boggling idea of, I don't think you phrase it quite like this, but sort of robot lib in the course of, in the course of the book, which is if we do actually build robots that are, you know, sufficiently human-like, then at what point do we start to say, well, you know, why should we get them to do all the horrible jobs? That's terribly unfair.
Yeah. Well, I think that's another example of framing a question really well. You know, if it gets to a point where even if the robot isn't conscious, but we take it to be conscious, when do we start to feel some responsibility for its, in brackets, human rights? And again, I think this is the most important thing about research into intelligence or intelligent machines, is it helps us focus attention on what it means to be clever. And, you know, we still don't know that ourselves. You know, what is consciousness is a question I ask a number of times in the book of various scientists, and they're all kind of go, we've got another question, you know.
Well, I suppose it could be argued that some of the greatest philosophers in the world have been battling over that one for
exactly.
some time.
But I think actually the forefront of that, Ray Kurzweil said to me, the great thing about these technologies is they do really start to force our hand and help us frame those questions better, as I said earlier. So I think that's, you know, one of the things I drew up from the book, is that the advance of technology actually helps us understand what it is to be human.
And we could all have a go. I had a go this afternoon at Eliza, which is the software which is apparently a sort of trying to be a psychotherapist, I think.
Eliza is a very early attempt to get machines to have natural language, which is, you know, the idea, the sort of way we're talking now, this not formal but a conversational style, and it tries to mimic what psychotherapists do, a thing called reflection, which is where you restate what the your client has said to you.
So it's very much, and how does that make you feel?
Well, it's actually restating what they've said. So if you say, you know, oh, you know, I hate my wife, then, you know, the therapist might go, well, you're feeling some animosity towards you. They're basically restating, but the idea is it helps you open up. And so they program this into a machine, and it's quite good for a bit, and then it falls over. And I ended up having a conversation with Eliza, and she said, you know, what's your name? And I said, Mark. And she said, well, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I'm trying to find out about the future. And she went, do you think that's normal? And I thought, this is actually quite good. This is a really good question. And after a while, I said, well, yeah, actually, I think that is normal. And she went, I see. And at that point, it just felt like a bit like an awkward silence. So I said, you don't do well at parties, do you? And this is where it all went wrong, because she went, why do you want to do me at parties? And so we ended up in this kind of, ended up like a sort of a dodgy porno script from 1974, because she hadn't really got the irony in my statement. And actually, natural language is one of those things that we found incredibly difficult to get machines to do, which is why what's happened with Watson at IBM is interesting, and actually, I think, quite an advance.
Yeah, I do recommend you try it, because I had a quick quick go on Eliza.
It's careful how you say
yes.
that.
And it was the most frustrating and bizarre conversation. Yeah. I got the normal question very quickly, and I said, yes, I think I'm normal, and how does that make you feel, I think. Anyway, I'm digressing, but yeah, you can look it up on Google and you can find it.
Yes, everybody should have a chat with Eliza. It'll make you feel good about yourself.
I'd like to move on to, I mentioned that we'd had Stuart Brand on the, you know, I'm a massive fan of, who we had on the show a while back, and I'd like, you talk later in the book about technology and sort of the way it can help the green movement and the way we can basically save the planet. So let's look at some of those things.
Well, there's so many. That's one of the things I came away most surprised about, was how many options we do have to actually deal with the climate change threat in quite short order if we get our act together. And I became increasingly angry that our governments really weren't getting their head around it. So one example is a guy called Klaus Lackner, who is, he's no flake. He's a serious chemist out of Columbia University. And he's invented a machine, and I've been to his laboratory and seen it working, that scrubs carbon dioxide out of the ambient air and does it relatively cheaply. I mean, it's, it costs a bit of energy, but, not too much. And we're talking about saving the planet here. This isn't like a normal economic transaction. He can take carbon dioxide out of the air. But then I realised, we think of carbon dioxide as a pollutant. It's actually a resource. You can do interesting things with it. And another company I talk to can take that carbon dioxide, feed it through a photosynthesizing bacteria that's had its genome altered, and it will excrete petrol. So you can create a carbon neutral petrol station you can put anywhere on the planet. This technology exists. It's not science fiction. There's people racing to commercialize it, but Klaus is finding it hard to get funding. He's finding it hard because he's saying that climate change is serious, so the fossil fuel people don't like him. And he's also saying, but actually, if you adopt my technology, we can carry on using fossil fuels. So the Greens don't like him either. So I'm actually in the process of trying to raise him the $20 million he needs to take his thing to the next stage. And I'm having some interesting conversations about that, and hopefully sort of in 6 months we should be a long way to giving him his money.
Well, again, going right back to the beginning where you talk about bioengineering in the beginning of the book, that technology exists. Like, you can literally turn up at a lab, get a gallon of diesel that's been made by genetically modified E. coli.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably watched a great series called The Cell, which had Adam Rutherford,
who has been on this show.
Yeah, Adam Rutherford, who I'm a huge fan of. And there's a bit in The Cell, I think it's in the third episode, where he turns up at a company called LS9, which is advised by George Church, who I see in the book, who's the professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. And he does. He literally, pours this stuff into his, I think it's into a generator, and starts it off. And this stuff has been made by feeding, I think in that case, sugarcane to a bacteria that's, put it through its gut and excreted diesel. It's not science fiction. This stuff exists.
I'd like to look a little bit more about the CO2 scrubbing thing. So how does that actually, what does that mean?
Well, it means that we potentially take carbon dioxide out of the air. Now, on one side of Klaus's machine, you've got carbon dioxide levels that we have now, and on the other side of the machine, you have carbon dioxide levels that are less than at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And enough of those machines, we could just reclaim the carbon load that we've put into the atmosphere. In fact, we worked out, me and Klaus said, you need 100 million. And that sounds like a lot of machines until you realise we make 73 million cars every single year. Mm-hmm. So it's not an insurmountable problem. In fact, I've been having a conversation only yesterday with a car manufacturer about the possibility of them, if the technology gets to the point where they will make one machine for every 10 cars they produce.
Couldn't just put them in the cars, wouldn't that be easy?
They're bigger than that. The idea is they'll be the size of a shipping container, and they will take a ton of carbon dioxide out per day. You wouldn't want a shipping container on the back of your car because you'd have to use so much fuel to carry it around that just the whole thing wouldn't work.
Well, that was the obvious point that I was wondering whether we would actually need to sort of power up a whole load of fossil-fuel-powered power stations just to run these things.
Yeah, and what Klaus has done the calculations, and he reckons, yes, if you plug it in and you power it via a coal-fired power plant, you'll, for every 200 molecules of CO2 it's responsible for putting into the air, because of how it's powered, it will pull out 1,000.
Which is pretty good.
So 5-1 upside.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I'd just like to, just to finish off, we've got a couple of minutes left. Richard mentioned in the introduction that you run a couple of sort of science promotion agencies.
Yeah.
And we've raised this idea that there is, there's a lot of pessimism around and how a lot of the technologies that you talk about in this book are fantastic, and people aren't necessarily aware of them. And I wonder, why that is, what we can do about that, what we're doing wrong, basically, in terms of the promotion of these technologies.
That's a really great question. It's something that occupies me a lot and I've been thinking about a lot. I'm probably going to offend a few people here. I think the scientific community itself has a lot to answer for, in that the science communication is seen by many senior scientists as something a little bit shabby. and actually you're not really a proper scientist if you're engaging with the public. I mean, this isn't a new story. I mean, Carl Sagan and Richard Feynman both suffered absolutely. At the hands of their colleagues for engaging with the public. I mean, and you know, if I had a pound for every time somebody had lightly dusted down Brian Cox in out of his earshot but within mine, saying he's not really a proper scientist, I could probably take Brian out for quite a nice dinner. Obviously, I wouldn't tell him how I funded it. You know, I'm Brian. Guess how I paid for this. There's this kind of perception within the scientific community that you can't really champion science unless you've actually done a lot of it, or at least read lots of books by Roger Penrose. I don't think that's true. You know, I'm not gay, but I believe that we shouldn't discriminate based on sexuality. I don't think you have to be a scientist to believe that the world should be evidence-based. And the gay community, you know, made this... hugely forward by coming out and fighting and saying that, you know, being homophobic is vulgar. And I think we need to be the same about pseudoscience. In fact, I'm thinking of setting up a sort of a pseudoscience trading, emissions trading scheme, whereby every time the Daily Mail publishes something that's rubbish, they have to give some money to cancer research to offset their nonsense.
Or they could plant some trees or something.
No, they have to give some money to scientific research. It's a definite offset. You've misrepresented science. Yeah, you've been completely foolish.
They'd probably give it to some kind of ghost researcher or something.
No. I mean, it's obviously a offset scheme that is regulated and it goes to proper scientific research. So you can still carry on peddling your homeopathy, but there is now a cost. You have to trade it for real science.
Are you still doing many stand-up gigs?
Not a huge amount, no. I've got much more into writing now and all these business adventures that are now coming my way. And my last gig actually was in Harvard, which is interesting crowd. You don't get heckled so much. I did this gig in Harvard and it was brilliant and a lovely, very intelligent crowd, you know, very
very partisan. Brainy heckles.
Yeah, I didn't get any heckles. I came off stage and a woman said to me, yeah, that fourth joke, I think you're referring to a particular neuroanatomy paper that came out of Holland, and I think your joke is slightly wrong. I think you've misread the paper, and let me talk to you about the third chapter in it. And so it wasn't you're heckled and like, oh, you're rubbish, get off, more like, I think you've misread the science slightly. So yeah, that was the last gig I did, and that actually probably is what stopped me doing so many gigs.
We're out of time, Mark. Thank you very much for coming and talking to Little Lambs today.
Well, brilliant. It's one of my favourite shows, so it's an absolute pleasure to be on it.
And the book is An Optimist's Tour of the Future, and it's very enjoyable.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.